session number 9420, reel 1.
Mr. Bill Gilman, Reel 1. Could you tell me something about your background before the First World War, Mr. Gilman?
Well, of course, I was at school when the war broke out in 1914 because I stayed in X7 standard then until my birthday arrived, which was 4 months to October. After the August holiday, I went back, finished my time at school till I was 14 on the 4th of October. Then, of course, I got a job as a porter, shop porter.
When were you born?
On October the 4th, 1899.
And what area were you living in? Or were you
I was living at Leytonstone then. And, of course, as I say, when I left school, I went and got a job as a shop porter at a wine merchant's, where I learned all about wines and all that kind of thing.
What was that school? Could you tell me a little about your education?
Harrow Green School, and I've got a reference here from the headmaster. I can read out to you if you want it. And he was a very good headmaster, one of the old school, and it was a ragged ass school, and it was purely elementary education because we had no none of these. Rates and what they fix it at now in education, what do they call them, standards.
O-levels.
O-levels, that's it. We never had any levels in those days. There was no classifications at all. It was purely elementary education. And
what did you mean when you said it was a ragged-ass school? What do you mean by that?
Well, I meant it was just an elementary school. There was not like in the Harrow and Eton class or the or even grammar. Well, there weren't even any grammar schools at that time in 14. The Education Acts were very, very antiquated, and it wasn't really until 1944 Education Act that they really got to grips with the educational standards of any type, you know, worth mentioning.
You said something about the standard you were in. What, could you explain that system?
Well, the standards were the same as they have in classes now. Instead of calling them classes, they called them standards then, and it started at Standard 1 in the infants. And then it went up to 7. That was the top standard. And then if you had to stay over like I did for the extra 4 months to complete my, to my 14th birthday, and everybody went at 14. Nobody was stayed at school after 14. Then, of course, you go through the standards from 1 progressively each year as you advance, you know. Like they do now in the various classes, I think they do it in classes now, forms, don't they?
What did your father do for a living?
He was a shipping clerk, a ship's clerk, really. He used to tally the cargo on and off vessels for Scrattons in the docks. And he had a variety of jobs. He was the sort of black sheep of the family out of... there were 6 brothers, and 5 of whom were missionaries, and used to travel all over they went to all the various countries with the natives, you know, and I think it was the London City Mission. I didn't know or didn't bother about it in those days, what the ancestry was. I was more concerned about just the normal ramifications of kids and playing about, more or less. I used to read a lot. I used to ask him to interpret meaning of words because I was an avid reader, And he said, don't ask me. He said, I'll give you a dictionary. And I learnt my majority of my words and knowledge of words from the dictionary that he gave me. And I took to it so much that I was top grammar school boy in my school. And I was just waved on one side when they were taking questions because they knew I knew the answers. It was that kind of thing, you know. Otherwise, I wasn't all that wonderful at arithmetic like my father was. He could go down three columns of figures with three fingers and sort off and get the total the three together. He had a marvellous arithmetical brain, but I didn't.
Was the family well off at all?
No.
What no, sort of background?
Actually, my grandfather, who lived next door but one to me there, he was a foreman plate line in Trincomalee in Ceylon, and he built the bridge over the river from that goes from Colombo to Trincomalee, joins the two towns together or something. And of course, I've still got his old oak chest upstairs that they brought over with them, with the rope handles, you know, and they came probably an antique, but we just felt it got a bit of junk in it. But anyway, there's been no distinctions in the family or anything like that.
Did you have enough? Were you well fed and housed and clothed?
Oh, yes. I mean, the domestic routine and discipline was good. I wasn't allowed to put elbows on the table or talk while I was eating. It was that kind of discipline that was at home. And I didn't object because I didn't know any difference. You just got a clip against the ear if you didn't do as you were told, and it was just as quick as that.
Did you join, were you involved in the church lads or the scouts?
Nothing of that, no. Any kind. No, I'm afraid that from a leisure time point of view, other than reading, I used to read about Billy Bunter and all those. That was my favourite, the only thing I really took an interest in, used to follow that through. And other than that, it was just playing in the street. That's what made me say it was an elementary or working class education.
Now, you were still at school when the war broke out. Can you remember anything about August the 4th, the day of the war broke out, what you were doing?
Oh, yes, I used to read the newspapers, you know. And we used to pick up information from people that came and chatted, the neighbours talk and all the general things, and I don't think the pictures had even started then, moving pictures. But when they did, of course, we were able to follow a lot of it through Movietone News.
What did you think when the war broke out? What did you think about it?
Oh, I thought it was great, you know. We wanted to fight the Germans straight away. They were said to be our enemies because of the normal national propaganda. Same as it was, I was eager to join up.
In the area where you lived, was there any attacks on German-sounding?
Yes, there was, yes. So the butcher's shops and the bakers, the German butchers and bakers at Leighton's down there, their windows smashed. And, of course, people got panicky about it because there was an extreme feeling of nationalism in it, you know, because they were... The Kaiser was no good. He was an evil man, and he wanted this war, and he'd trained all his troops and things in the Navy. And then, of course, our national feeling arose, and the British Navy would soon show him sort of business, you know. Patriotism was very, very high. And there was hardly any indication of sympathy for the Germans at all.
Did you see any of these attacks on butchers or bakers?
Yeah. No, we only saw them because, I was a kid, and we didn't see them at the time they were being, because they were mainly done in the night time, as is usual with these sort of things. And of course, all we saw was the places boarded up, and the rumour went round very fast when the local shop, the shops that we knew that were German owned and had German names over the fascia, oh, have you heard that so and so's window's been smashed, you know? And it was an accepted thing that the feeling ran high, and of course this was the inevitable result. Nobody questioned it and thought it was wrong and that it wasn't their fault. See, it wasn't. They were completely innocent, these people. And then some of them we knew personally as trading, who we traded with, you know, in shopping. And it was rather a shame, in a way, that this sort of thing did happen, as it inevitably does in the time of war, where you take sides and you lose a little bit of logic and reason.
Now, you left school in October of 1914. You said you got a job at a wine merchant's. Could you tell me something about what your job was?
Yes, I used to ride a tricycle, one of the old-fashioned tricycles that you had the two big wheels in front and box behind you, and a little wheel which you guided with a handle at the side. And you pedalled it, because there was very little motive power in those days. From an automatic standard and petrol or anything like that. Motor cars were almost unknown. And of course, it was interesting because it was a new world to me, coming out of school and going into it, because jobs were very scarce then.
Did you get a job straight away?
Yes. I applied for it from an advertisement in the paper. I went down because I was big, and they wanted one of these people who could shift crates of beer about and bottles and all this kind of thing. And to me, it was child's play because I was big, you know, as I am now. And it was just, I was the ideal sort of person or kid they wanted in a shop. And as I say, I used to deliver and the orders out to the fraternity. A lot of the residential people in Wanstead I used to serve. And in that way I learnt all about wines, liqueurs, beers and aperitives and all those sort of things. And it stood me in good stead because when I did mix later in life in company, where he did use these things in a bit of a higher level, as it were, that it was commonplace for those people, it came naturally. I understood exactly what the type of wine they were talking about and the vintages, the various classes of scotch and liqueurs, and it was very, very helpful. I enjoyed it.
Did you drink at all while you were working in that?
No.
Job?
We used to drain some of the bottles out if the wine was sweet, you know, but as kids would. And there was two other boys there with me as well. But they're both already there. They were older. They didn't last long, but I carried on for 18 months.
Did the firm lose any people to the war? Did they go and enlist? Can you remember?
No. It was purely a shop. Oh, a complete wine shop. They sold nothing. One thing they sold was cocoa. Strangely enough, they had a barrel of cocoa and it used to be weighed out on scales. I remember that. And when there was a spare moment in stacking bottles or other things like connected with the wine, stock, I used to be put on weighing cocoa out into quarter of an ounce, half ounce packets, and not quarter of an ounce, but half ounce and ounce packets, not ounce, half pounds, you know, and so forth.
Did the war affect your life much? Because you were there 18 months, that takes you into 1916.
No.
Did it affect you?
No. Of course, we were more interested and excited by the war itself because of the Zeppelins started coming over.
What can you tell me about Zeppelins, the Zeppelins?
Well, we used to get these air raid warnings. And then, of course, we were warned generally by a notice to everybody in the usual national propaganda issued to the government to be wary and take cover. And and the bloke used to come round on a bicycle and blowing his whistle and saying, take cover, take cover. You know, when these zeppelins came over, we were more interested, we didn't worry about it. And there were no shelters in those days, only just you went indoors. And, of course, you were looking up in the sky and watching the searchlights, which were dotted all over the sky, crisscrossing. And then you see the shells bursting up there. Then when a searchlight picked up a zeppelin, just like a silver cigar in the sky. And, of course, I saw that one that was brought down in flames and all the dead bodies and debris dropping from it, all alight, you know, up in the sky. That was at Cuffley, I think it was. We could see that, you know, because it was so high up, and it was a terrific sight to see the whole thing lighting gradually, the small flame, and then expanding from end to end. And, of course, down it came. Always there was great excitement then in the newspapers. It was a marvellous news item for everybody.
Were the general population scared, or was it just the kids who were excited? Were people scared by the bombs?
Oh, yes, they used to get out of the way, used to run indoors and all this kind of thing. And that. Of course, there was no comparison. The raids were only spasmodic, you know. And, of course, we had a few aeroplanes up there that was chasing them. And it was no comparison to the Second War. I've been able to compare the two, obviously, through my close experience with them both.
Was there any panic?
No, I wouldn't say there was, because it was so scattered, you know, and the Zeppelins appeared to avoid London. You know, they'd go round London, and that's how it appeared to me, anyway. And, of course...
Did any bombs drop on Leytonstone?
No. No, we had no bombs around there. I had no experience of the bombing at all.
What was your next job after leaving the wine merchants?
Well, then I got a job at the fur factory at Rises, because I was getting a bit old for the shop boy's job, you know. And I left there and found this job at George Royce's in Stratford.
And that was in August 1916?
That's right, yes. And...
What did you have to do there? What was your job there?
I worked with an old German dyer, strangely enough, who obviously, because of his knowledge, because he had secret knowledge about certain dyes for dyeing the fur, and they had sables and foxes and all the valuable furs that they used to do there. They were very well known for furnished fur skin people. And, of course, they used to do the pelts of the animals as well. But I used to help the old German on the dyes. And he was a good old boy to work with, and he spoke in broken English. But, of course, he was a very, very valued member there, because he apparently was the only one who knew the secret of the mixing of the dyes and how to make them up. And they were in huge tubs. And we had a leather apron and all the gear for protective gear then put on. And I used to run about with them, carry and fetch, you know, for the various items that were necessary to help him to make the dyes up and convey the furs that he'd tipped off. They used to tip the furs with the dyes so that the top of the fur was a different colour to the roots of it, you know, and all that. It's quite an art, that trade, you know, a trade, a craft, really. And
Were you meant to be learning the trade?
No, I was only a scissor. There was no hope, because everybody knew that I was due to go in the army, you see, and I wanted to go too, in the army, because I wanted to fight the Germans, you know, like we all did as youngsters. Didn't realise the amount of casualties and the death and destruction that it involves. And you look at it in a different world when you're that age. You know, when you're about 18, you're full of adventure and so forth, and so was I. and the Germans are the wicked, you know, and all this, and this is the attitude.
Did you not know then about the conditions on the Western Front, the trenches and the squalor?
No, we didn't. We were never told that. It was just a matter that we'd managed to gain a few yards, you know, and we had suffered a few casualties here and there. It was played down, and I only knew that when I got there, you see, and even when I got to ETAPS, and we were doing a bit of training preparatory to going up the line, and we were actually suffering very heavy casualties. I learnt after that the expectation of life was 6 weeks when I went out. And, of course, even there, we were kept more or less with the intensive training and the hurry to get us up to help.
Was there not a lot of casualties from people you knew in the Leytonstone area or, you know, brothers of your friends?
No, we never knew, never met anybody at all. Never met anybody. Oh, you mean when at home, you mean?
No, I mean when you were in England, while you were at the fur factory, for instance, did you not notice there were a lot of casualties from the lot of people you knew?
We lived in our own little lives, you know. My life was in the wine merchants, I'm being quite honest with you. We never thought much about neighbours or anything like this, you see. We just simply did our job. We were full of the youthful excitement of living, as it were, or seeing and hearing about events and the Zeppelins coming over. And
You said the German dyer spoke broken English. Yeah. Did he have any problems? Because he would obviously...
No, he didn't. No, they liked the old boy because, for one thing, they knew that the firm valued him very highly, you know, because of his knowledge, and consequently they just left him alone, accepted him, because they knew that he wasn't to blame for the war. He was sensible enough to know that. And you do, same as we sometimes pitied the people whose shops had been raided and ransacked and vandalised. Well, there was a certain amount of pity for them because we were sensible enough. It doesn't destroy all reason and logic. We realised that they weren't responsible for the war. It was the Kaiser. He was the villain of the piece.
What about the popular attitude to conscientious objectors?
We didn't have a very high opinion for them, of course. The old White Feather Brigade used to get at it, you know. And patriotism was the sole driving motive of the British people, all round generally. And no one had much time for conscientious objectors. We probably attributed unfair reasons to them. Sometimes they were thought to be cowards, and others, you know, were cranks, and this is what the attitude of people towards them. And as many of them took refuge in political associations, which they used to as a reason for... and they really believed, I think, that it was wrong to kill. But there was no question, apparently, that whether it was wrong for the other people to kill us. This is the two sides of war.
Now, you left the fur factory around about April 1917. Where did you go then?
On the railway. See, I got fed up, and with the fur, I couldn't see any. As a matter of fact, it was not interesting to me. I was of an inquiring nature, always have been, and I wanted to change it, to be honest. And the railway offered itself, and I got the word that they wanted some mates on the railway, you know, and. At the Stratford Works, which at that time was one of the main industries in Stratford. And it's pretty good now, but it's nowhere near like it was. It's turned into a container depot now, more or less.
What exactly was your job then?
Boilermaker's mate, you see. And as I said, we used to go across the running shed when the engines came in with copper stays leaking in the firebox. We used to get in there with a sack, knock the stays down to stop the leak in the firebox, and then go back onto onto another job, or back to the engine repair shop where I worked. I worked in the engine repair shop where they repaired big expresses and tank engines and all that. And that was another heavy job, and of course I learned how to use a hammer, and I'm ambidextrous. I could use a hammer very accurately with left or right hand. And then when I told them at the recruiting office, they wanted to know my occupation.
We'll come to that, because I'll ask you about that. What other duties, would you have in the engine repair yard? What would you actually be doing when an engine came in to be repaired? What would you do as the boilermaker's mate?
Well, actually, sometimes I'd have to cut a piece out of the firebox, you see, and repair it. And you helped the platers too. You used to cut out the covers for the boilers, the engine cover itself. And of course, we had tenders in the shop there as well. But my main job was in the boilermakers for knocking down rivets, you know, steel rivets, 7/8 of an inch thick, some of them, in the frames of the engine. You know, the steel frames. The frames are 1 inch thick of the actual engine itself, and they had to be riveted to other parts of the chassis of the engine. And the rivets were that thick, 7/8 of an inch thick. And there were steel rivets, and you had to hit them hard enough to spread them out to rivet the two plates together. And, of course, you had to be hefty. And I had muscles standing out just like, you know, melons sort of business. And I was fit as a fiddle, as you'll know. On my military record, I was past A1. Although, funnily enough, they booked me down for a cook's job, and I never looked at a cookhouse all the time I was in there. That's the army.
At the engine repair yards, had the war affected things at all?
Yes, it had really, because there were no men cleaners left, and there were all women cleaners there, and of course we used to try out them a bit, because they were new to the job, and they were the usual gang of gossipy women that you'd get together. And they did a good job, because they had to take the place of the firemen, the young firemen who'd been called up, and in some cases drivers, although it was controlled to a certain extent, because obviously they were an accepted profession. So far as the firemen was concerned, of course they had to control those. But with cleaners, anybody can do cleaning, because it wasn't a craft and in the line of progression which used to work from those days. Because in the early days before the war, it used to be all males. The cleaners were males. They progressed from there to firemen, from firemen to drivers, and that's how they carried on.